We will talk about election recounts, cabinet picks, gerrymandering, flip-flops, and much more during this post-Thanksgiving edition, the Black Friday edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We welcome you to call in on the story that you want to talk about. What story in the news this week matters most to you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. Rick Essenberg is with us, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Joy.
And Louis Fortas is with us, Editor-in-Chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee, formerly a member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. Good morning to you, Louis.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Rick.
I hope you both had good Thanksgivings and you didn't have big political family feuds around the Thanksgiving table.
Well, we were well fed and ready to fight for today here among these big issues coming up, and I'm sure Rick feels the same way.
Yeah. We talk more about football.
Yeah. Well, there are some big issues. Let's start with what we just learned over the past couple of days. We have Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate, preparing to request recounts of the election result in several key battleground states, including Wisconsin. She launched an online fundraising page seeking donations, citing election or voting anomalies. It looks like the Wisconsin election people are preparing for that recount. Louis Fortas, do you think we should recount the Wisconsin vote?
I think if Jill Stein's campaign is willing to pay for it, and it's supposed to cost, they're estimated at about $1 million, I think that's just fine. I think it's actually good. What it does is it'll either show that there's a problem or it'll, you know, kind of settle things, and then people can, you know, understand that, you know, they lost or they won or whatever the case may be. But I don't see anything wrong with getting more information. I think what happened in 2000 when the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, stopped the vote counting in Florida was a real travesty. And I think that, you know, more information is good. In 2004, people questioned Ohio because of the voting machines and because the, I think it was Diebold, the CEO of Diebold said he was going to make sure Ohio was going to go for Bush. You know, after him saying that and after Ohio being, you know, a state that people expected to go for Kerry and went for Bush, you know, recounts will settle the argument. So I think it's just, I think it's more than fine. I think it's very, very good.
What do you think, Rick?
Oh, it's much ado about nothing. I mean, look, I understand that, you know, when you don't win an election, it's disappointing. It's hard for you to believe that people actually might have disagreed with you and made a choice other than the one that you would have made. But there's no reason to think that there are election anomalies. I mean, people talk about the polling errors, but the polling errors really were within, you know, the historic margin of errors is about a 2-point error nationally, and a 2-point error is something that you expect to happen frequently when you're polling. So I don't think that there's really anything to see here. I suppose if Jill Stein's campaign, I don't know where they'd get the money, but if they want to pay for a recount, I'm fine, go ahead and do it, but it's a waste of time.
There were three computer scientists who say they looked at voting patterns in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, I think, and they were encouraging Hillary Clinton's campaign to actually call for this recount because of it was some sort of you know, that the vote count was suppressed in certain counties. Lewis, I don't think Hillary Clinton, though, was taking them up on this request. It is Jill Stein who's taking them up on this request.
I think it's very hard for someone like Hillary in Hillary's position to start saying, well, you know, I didn't really lose, and therefore, you know, there should be a recount. when it's three state when three states are involved. So I think it's very hard. I don't know how she personally feels, and she may think there needs to be a recount, but it's hard because you're going to get all the arguments that Rick just gave it, you know, that this is much to do about nothing, and it's being a poor loser, and things of that sort. So I think it's very hard for her. Jill Stein's in a different situation. So if she wants to go ahead and do it, you know, go for it, and I think that would settle it, and I think people would feel much better.
And I don't see why. I mean, if the Clinton campaign thought that there was something there, I don't see why they wouldn't call for a recount. I think that, you know, they know they lost. You know, Nate Silver, who is the proprietor of 538.com and certainly no Republican, has been sharply critical of what they've done. I mean, I think what happened here is that, you know, Hillary Clinton didn't bring out the vote that Barack Obama did. And I think that because of that, perhaps because Trump made some inroads into constituencies that were not traditionally Republican, although I'm skeptical about that, she lost the election. It was a close election. In part, she didn't get the votes where she needed to get the votes. She didn't do well in the upper Midwest. I think now she would agree that not coming to Wisconsin after she had sewed up the nomination was a big mistake. I think she made others, and she lost. She knows she lost, and you know, we time to move on.
Yeah, another.
I think there's one other thing, and if you're going to start saying all the mistakes she's made, and every campaign makes thousands and thousands of mistakes, but when you have head of the FBI, a Republican, come out 11 days before the election when he said he wouldn't question the Russian involvement because it might, you know, make Trump look bad this close to the election. But he comes out with absolutely no basis. We found new emails, which gave, you know, kind of the suggestion that there, we finally found the smoking gun and all of that. 11 days, just when her polling started to really start moving up, and it was really everything was moving in the right direction for the Hillary campaign, Comey stepped in. If you don't think that that had a major effect, Rick, then I don't know how you view politics.
You know, I'm sorry, because I don't know if we can go back to rehash, only because in the Week in Review we talk about you know, this week's news and not last week's news. But let's go to Steve and Danbury next. Hi, Steve.
All right, thanks for taking the call. First of all, it's not a recount they're calling for. It's an audit. A recount would probably yield the same result. An audit would reveal irregularities. Secondly, the standard bearer of the Republican Party, right up till the election, said he wouldn't necessarily accept the results. Now that the tables are turned, Republicans are crying foul. That seems like a double standard to me.
So Donald Trump said the system was rigged, but are Republicans saying move on now, Rick Essenberg?
Well, I'm saying move on now because I don't see any evidence that that there were any type of election irregularities. I certainly wouldn't regard it as inconsistency on my part because I didn't think Donald Trump ever should have said that during the general election. I think it was irresponsible for him to say that the election was rigged. He shouldn't have said it, but that doesn't change the fact that you know, he won, and I think that there really isn't any basis for you know, these black helicopter theories about, you know, conspiracies and irregularities that are unlikely to lead to anything.
Lewis?
Yeah, Rick isn't a statistician or a computer analyst, and so and neither am I, and so neither one of us are experts as to whether there is a problem. And so by law, the losing person does have a right to pay for the recount, and I don't see any or audit in this case, as the caller correctly pointed out. But I see absolutely nothing wrong with doing this, and I think this idea, and I think he's right. I think if it was the other way around, Rick would be arguing very differently today.
One other, the caller's right. There is an audit being requested or a recount. I think it says recounts or audits of the election results. The one of the concerns was, did the Russians hack the computers? And elections officials are saying that no, that is like nearly impossible to do. But here's a recount being requested in the state of Wisconsin by Republican state Senate candidate, former Republican state senator Dan Kopanky in the La Crosse area. He is requesting a recount in his race against Jennifer Schilling, who was reelected. State Senator Jennifer Schilling was reelected by only 56 votes. In that 32nd district race. A quick thoughts, Lewis, on whether we might see even a bigger red wave with Dan Kopanky possibly, getting this recount and defeating Jennifer Schilling.
I think he's entitled to a recount with something that close. And when I was in the legislature, when I first started talking about recounts, I thought, the polls are perfect. There are mistakes that you have people at the polling places that when they turn in the numbers, they might inadvertently transpose it. Instead of saying it was, 483, they would turn in 438. And things like that do occur. And so when it is that close, I think he's entitled to and has a right to a recount.
Rick?
Well, yeah, 56 votes is really, really close. I think that, state law provides for a recount in those circumstances, if I'm not mistaken. I think probably it's more likely than not that you won't flip 56 votes in a recount, but, you don't know until you try, and I think it's perfectly appropriate to do it.
This is the Week in Review. We are talking the politics, the top stories in state and national politics during this edition of the Week in Review. When we come back, we will talk about some developments on the transition to the Donald Trump administration, some of his cabinet picks, and welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And we'll also talk about how Donald Trump sounds like he's evolving, his position's softening on some issues. For example, he wants to move past the Clinton investigations. He's no longer saying lock her up. So what do we think about that? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. On this post-Thanksgiving edition of the Week in Review, we are talking with Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and Louis Fortas, who is Editor-in-Chief of the Shepherd Express. And you can join in to bring up an issue or to talk about an issue that's important to you that was in the news this week, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Moving on, President-elect Donald Trump told the New York Times this week that prosecuting Bill and Hillary Clinton would be very, very divisive for the country, and in essence, he's not going there. Rick, is Trump right to move on here, or should he stick to his campaign promise and appoint a special prosecutor and put her in jail?
I think he's absolutely right. I think I'm a pretty good lawyer. If you look at the elements of the statute, the elements of the crime, and you compare what Comey found that Mrs. Clinton did with the elements of the statute, she clearly broke the law. Right? She probably should have been prosecuted. That didn't happen. I think, however, to go ahead and do that now would be, from Trump's perspective, would be a distraction from his agenda. I think it would unnecessarily roil the country. I think that Gerry Ford was right when he pardoned Richard Nixon, and I'm actually pleasantly surprised that
that Donald Trump has had the good judgment, you know, to put this thing to rest so early. I think he was, I think he's doing the right thing. And once again, I think we, you know, we should move on to the challenges that the country faces and, you know, see what the Trump administration looks like.
So, Louis, are you encouraged by this bit of news?
Well, first of all, I kind of agree with Rick on this one. But the only difference is I am not a lawyer, but every attorney I've spoken to who knows something about this says the law was not broken, that what she did was, you know, maybe poor judgment, and then she totally regrets what she did, believe me. But it didn't break the law. But the interesting thing that you have in a situation like this is you have the Karl Rove strategy is, again, to attack your opponent for your weaknesses. You have Trump with his 4,000 lawsuits. There was, if there's anything, there's probably fraud on that Trump University, but he kind of settled that very quickly now. He lied to the IRS, and this is just coming out now, about his foundation, saying that and he never used his foundation to enrich himself and all. And now they've changed the little check mark on the latest IRS form saying, yes, we did. And he was diverting money from the foundation for pictures of himself or paying off somebody in Florida. So those are the things. If you're looking at somebody who might and should be prosecuted, I think he should look in the mirror. But I think starting out right now, I think he, you know, he and the people advising Trump realize that there is no reason to be trying to prosecute Hillary because, you know, Comey came out and said, you know, there is nothing that any reasonable prosecutor would go forward with. So I think for him to settle it now is smart, unlike the birther issue when it was real clear that, you know, Obama was born in the United States and he went on for another 5 years. I give him credit for learning that, you know, maybe you just drop it. So I give him credit for that.
Briefly, Rick, maybe Donald Trump doesn't think he should proceed with this because he's got enough skeletons in his closet?
Well, you know, look, I mean, I was pretty clear that I wasn't impressed by either one of these candidates during the election campaign. Now, you know, I think that, you know, the Clintons can go on now and they can do what they have proven themselves to be remarkably adept at doing, and that is earning a lot of money, incredible amounts of money, for doing precisely nothing. Now, I'm not sure they're going to be able to do that anymore because the prospect that they will ever exercise power is now gone. You know, the shakedown operation called the Clinton Foundation may not do as well in the future as it has in the past. But, you know, we can sit there and we can trade barbs back and forth about, you know, who's worse and who's better. And, you know, once again, I wasn't a fan of either one of these candidates. But fact of the matter is that, you know, Trump is the president of the United States now, or will be president of the United States. And, you know, we ought to, you know, talk about what that should mean. I think this is going to be very, very interesting because I don't think we've ever elected someone who was really as much of a blank slate when it came to policy as Trump is. And so I think that there's going to be a battle within the Republican Party and the conservative movement over the heart and mind of Donald Trump. So far, I've got to say, it looks a lot better than I thought it might look. But we're very early on, and we'll see what happens.
Let me talk of some of these battles that might be shaping up. In another seemingly change of position, Donald Trump says he is keeping an open mind on whether to remain part of a global climate change deal. He also said that there appears to be at least some link between humans and climate change. He did previously say that he would accept a fence another maybe even technological barrier rather than a wall over all of the border with Mexico. He said that repealing and replacing Obamacare might include amending Obamacare to keep some of the good stuff. He seems to be evolving or flip-flopping on some of these important issues that helped that were top issues in the campaign. Rick, what do you make of this?
Well, I'm not surprised because, once again, I don't think that, you know, Trump was a guy who had thought hard about any of these issues. Now, you know, there could be an upside to this. I mean, it could be that he's not wedded to rigid ideological positions. You mentioned, you know, the issue of climate change. You know, we generally have this silly debate about climate change. We argue about whether it's happening and about whether human activity might contribute to it. But that's not where the debate really ought to be. The debate really ought to be what do we think is likely to happen, and what is it that we should do about it? And when you frame the debate in that way, it's not so clear. It's not so clear that accommodation rather than prevention isn't the best policy. You know, we could stay in the global climate accord, or we could get out of the global climate accord. But the one thing that seems to be certain about it is that accord itself isn't likely to change very much at all. I think that, you know, it could be that we can now begin to have the debate about that we should have, that where we shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't be sort of this argument between people who, you know, say that there's nothing to see here versus on the other side people who say that the sky is falling and we face imminent catastrophe, when really I think that the intelligent debate is in the middle.
Yeah. What do you think, Lewis?
Okay, there's a bunch of different topics that went on.
Right, I didn't want to go into detail on each of the topics, but the fact that he's changing his position on many of these topics.
So let me try to go back to your original question. He's a developer, and he's a smart guy. Trump is a smart guy. Trump has been a successful developer. You know, you can argue he got a big head start with his dad and all that stuff. But at the same time, I mean, the guy is a smart marketer. He won the election. But he has no understanding of public policy. This was totally, you know, kind of outside of his realm of thinking. He may know a lot about, you know, zoning codes and building zoning laws and building codes and things of that sort, but knows, you know, nothing about public policy. And I think, you know, he's been kind of getting, you know, he has Steve Bannon, the ultra-right, whispering in his ear, and then he goes and talks to other people, and he comes back and goes, oh, my God, you know. He's finding out it is a lot more complicated than he ever thought. And so dealing with the climate change thing, it is a serious issue. I don't know, Rick is trying to package it somehow. It is a very serious issue, and we are causing a total disruption in the planet, and we do have to deal with it. And that's why you have 195 countries coming together that don't agree on much of anything, coming to some kind of agreement. And then you have a couple of hundred U.S. corporations saying to Trump, don't mess with this. This is important stuff. And, you know, so he's beginning to realize there's, you know, these things are more complicated. I think the other thing was his torture. He was all in favor of more waterboarding and torturing. And then he talked to one retired Marine general who was nicknamed Mad Dog. And Mad Dog told him, you know, you're better off with cigarettes and offer him cigarettes and a beer rather than torturing him. And all of a sudden, he's backing off on that. So I think he is, he has a long way to go, and he may develop into, a very successful person, or he may, just become a disaster. And I think the thing that's interesting to watch are these early appointments. And he keeps talking about, I want to bring the country together. I want to heal the country. I want to, you know, I want everybody to be, you know, loving me. And he's making appointments that are really pretty extreme. And so it's discouraging to see the appointments, but it's consistent with his flopping all over the place.
We will get to those appointments in just a bit. But let me bring in Tim in Eau Claire, who has another issue that is in the news this week. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm hoping we could talk about DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and realistically, the news coverage on it. What I mean by that is it seems like just about every major news outlet, including public radio, has been reporting basically the police's story as the story that is happening, and saying it's really difficult to get anything from the ground when it's all over my Facebook. I can see live feeds of what is happening there, and it does not jive with what the police are saying. You know, there's pictures of water cannons on top of trucks, and the police are saying, no, we just had hoses and that sort of thing, and we only used them when they were charging us, and the people were walking towards them calmly. So, I mean, it's that kind of thing that just, it seems like nobody's actually reporting on the fact that there's this major standoff going on out there, and it's honestly infuriating, especially with public radio, because
I'm sorry, Tim. Let's not get into what public radio is or isn't doing on this. We've had a full hour with Paul DeMaine from Indian Country News talking about what's going on there, but we haven't in the last couple of days talked about this. Let's talk about the issue itself, and I guess whether or not media is covering it adequately. Lewis, any thoughts on that?
I think it's a more serious issue than a lot of the media is describing it as. So I will just kind of leave it at that.
No, that's all right. I mean, I just wanted to, I didn't want it to become a public radio coverage issue. You can talk about the media in general in terms of that, but the issue itself. There are people who are saying that President Obama should step in to put a stop to what's happening regarding this North Dakota pipeline. Do you think that the President Obama should step in, Lewis?
Well, you're dealing with separate nations when you're dealing with the tribes, and they have brought up issues that are, I think, real issues and are issues of concern, and I think it's important to deal with that. And I thought there was some kind of moratorium, and I think there is, and I think that the pipeline people say we have the license to go forward and we're just going to do it, and so it's becoming a much messier situation. And so, yeah, I think it, because you're dealing with separate nations as tribes are, then it is something where the federal government, definitely needs to step in. And in this case, it may get to the presidential level.
Yeah, a lot of people are driving out to or are spending their Thanksgiving holiday at the Standing Rock Reservation, bringing food and supplies and in support of the Indian tribe that's trying to stop the construction of this pipeline. And I got overly sensitive because I'd rather talk about the issue itself rather than just bashing the media for what they are or are not doing. Rick, your thoughts on what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a well-formed opinion about this particular pipeline. It does strike me that once again, though, it raises sort of a more fundamental issue as to whether or not the concept of tribal sovereignty is useful, either for the tribes themselves or for the public generally. I mean, it seems to me that whether or not this pipeline should be built probably ought not to turn on that issue legally. It probably does, but I think at some point, and maybe not in the near future, but in the midterm future, that whole concept is going to have to be revisited because I'm not sure it's doing anybody any good right now. But that's an entirely different issue.
We are talking with Rick Essenberg and Lewis Fortas during this edition of The Week in Review, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Speaking of media coverage, Donald Trump had an interview with the New York Times in which many developments that we have already discussed were revealed. Trump announced on Twitter, though, before that meeting, that he had canceled the meeting because the Times had changed the terms at the last minute, which the paper disputed. Hours later, that meeting was back on. He had an off-the-record talk with the publishers and an on-the-record conversation with reporters. He had similar meetings with other media outlets that he has in the past chastised as being unfair and dishonest. So what do you think, Lewis, as somebody who's involved with the press, do you have any thoughts on the relationship between President-elect Trump and the media?
Well, I think, first of all, the New York Times is the media the conservatives love to hate. And Donald Trump has to, you know, kind of go along with that. And I'm sure he's not real pleased with them because they are a world-class newspaper, and they have done a lot of fact-checking, and they've pointed out, you know, a ton of falsehoods that he has promoted and the like. But he is also a New Yorker, and this paper is important to him, and he reads the paper, and all the people he knows and deals with in New York read that paper. And that paper is very powerful, and newspapers still are very powerful. And so I think he can try to bully them, and he tried to do a little of that, but I think they're confident enough in who they are, and they're up for the challenge. So I thought it, at the end of the day, from everything I've read, is that it turned out to be a good meeting.
And he, I think he did call the New York Times a jewel after that. Rick, what do you think?
Yes.
Well, he said they had been nasty to him, and you know, he was right about that. They have been nasty to him. Look, I don't know if I love to hate the New York Times. I always say that one of my, you know, guilty and undisclosed, or actually I disclose it quite frequently, pleasures is, you know, that I like to sit down on a Sunday evening with the Sunday New York Times and a glass of Pinot Noir and read it, because it's great to have a paper that still has resources. Most papers don't. On the other hand, you know, I don't kid myself that the New York Times is somehow even-handed or neutral or doesn't cater to the presuppositions of its readers. It did. It went after Trump in an incredibly aggressive way. In fact, I think one of the real interesting things about this election campaign, and there was a study by the Kennedy School at Harvard, is the way that the coverage of the of Trump by the mainstream media flipped. Once he had won the nomination, he got very positive coverage and billions of dollars in earned media until he got the nomination. And then, having secured the nomination for the guy, they turned on him. I wonder whether some of the people in the editorial rooms are happy with the choice that they made in doing that.
Let's go to Grayson in Wakefield, Michigan. Hi, Grayson.
Good morning, ma'am. Thanks for letting me join in. I appreciate this. I was just—I don't spend a lot of time watching TV, and because I hate the controversy and getting all wound up. But I did go to a source of information, the Toronto Star, and their bureau chief in Washington kept track of the lies of both candidates, and they found that Mr. Trump had lied 560 times during his campaign season, about once every 20 minutes of talking. And so I think it's going to be really tough for you folks in the media, politicians and everything. If that rate of credibility stays like that, we're going to be jumping up and down all over the place. And it's going to be kind of hard. I mean, it was a tough emotional season as it was.
Yeah. So do you expect there will still be lots of fact-checking, and will the press be following President-elect Trump now, his actions more closely, Lewis?
First of all, I agree with Rick that they really, the press treated him very well during the primary and during those primary debates and all. And I don't think they really kind of held him accountable. And I thought that he was novel, and I think a lot of these veteran national news folks, you know, they're a little bored, and they find somebody who's a little different, a little more interesting, and they get intrigued. And so I do think once he became the nominee, I think it's okay, this is serious, and now we have to start treating him like a more serious candidate, because he did win. And so let's start holding him accountable for what he's saying. So if that's the reason, and that is the reason I believe why whatever coverage that Rick observed that changed, it was because they realized now we have to start treating him like an adult. I mean, he won the nomination. And going forward, I think what the caller points out is very, very difficult. I mean, we cherish the First Amendment and free speech, and we abhor any kind of prior restraint when it comes to you know, news coverage and the like. And at the same time, you had a campaign where you had a lot of lies. And so all I could hope is that going forward, there's just more effort by the media, and that means all of us, to
to really try to hold people accountable for their lies.
I'm going to jump in because we do have, we're way past break time, and we need to talk about cabinet picks and other top issues in the news. So if you'd like to join in, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Week in Review, talking this week with Rick Essenberg and Louis Fortas. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, inviting you to join in as we talk about the top stories in state and national politics at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So lots of cabinet picks. In fact, the very latest is that Betsy DeVos, I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, has been picked as Donald Trump's education secretary. She is known as being a school choice or school voucher supporter, not a big supporter, some would say, of public schools. So what do you make of that pick, Rick?
Well, I'm happy with the pick. I think that, you know, Betsy DeVos has been a leader in the education reform movement. And I think that what's interesting about it is that she wasn't, particularly enamored with Donald Trump. That she had said some things that were quite negative about him. The same is true of Nikki Haley, who also was highly critical of Donald Trump. You have reports, hasn't happened yet. We'll see whether it does, that, you know, Trump may make Mitt Romney Secretary of State. I'm not even sure that Romney voted for Trump, but he certainly criticized him in the harshest terms. And this is one of the things that's surprising to me, that, you know, one of the things that we worried about is that, you know, Trump would be vindictive given, you know, the vitriol that was directed against him, you know, not only by the Democrats, but also by significant elements of the conservative movement, including, you know, people like me. And he seems to be moving past that. He doesn't seem to be dwelling on that. And I have to say I'm pleasantly surprised by that.
Mm-hmm. Louis, earlier you were a little bit concerned. What do you make of these picks?
Well, let's start with Betsy DeVos. She is a scion of the right-wing Amway money, very, very, very wealthy. They have been funding every anti-public education, every public education kind of policy that's out there. She has no education, direct education experience, never been in a classroom, a principal, a superintendent, anything like that. She has no management experience. And the thing that's really kind of disgusting is, you know, here she is sitting back there with a ton of money. She is using it to intervene in a lot of local races. She is, where you have school board candidates, you know, working, going door to door. She's then pumping money into opponents, to buy the election for these, people who are supporting her experiments. And her experiments, her kind of free market experiments that she keeps proposing, using basically poor children, often children of color, you know, to try to prove things that have been falling short of being successful. And these are like these voucher programs and the like. I think she's an absolutely terrible appointment, and I think she's one that will have a lot of trouble getting confirmed. In terms of others, I think, do you want me to go on?
Yeah, I was going to say, well, what about the general point that Rick made that, hey, he Mitt Romney might be Trump's top choice for Secretary of State. He did appoint another critic as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. What about that?
Well, he hasn't appointed Romney yet, and all of a sudden, for a lot of people I know, and myself included, Romney looks pretty good these days. When you start comparing him to Rudy Giuliani and others, Romney is a sane, reasonable, guy who's not going to disgrace the United States on the world seen. So I think as Secretary of State, you know, that would be probably a very good choice from for that position. Nikki Haley is an interesting one. She came out very strongly against Trump, very strongly, when she endorsed Marco Rubio. And she has kind of shown that she's a bit of a class act at times. She came out very, she was very honorable and very, had a lot of integrity after the shooting in Charleston in the black church. She also pushed real hard to have the Confederate flag finally removed from the Capitol. Her big problem is she has absolutely no international experience. And they're trying to say, well, she's been courting some businesses to come to South Carolina. That's not international experience. That's basically business experience. So I think as choices go, I think she's a decent person. I just am worried that she will go there and be clueless. And again, this is complicated stuff, this foreign affairs and international issues. This is not for amateurs.
Yeah. So Rick, while you're impressed that he's maybe reaching out to some of his former rivals, what about these specific concerns that Lewis is bringing up?
Well, I mean, look, I think Betsy DeVos is someone who is, she's a philanthropist and she's committed to making her country better. Now, Lewis doesn't agree with her about how that should be done in the field of K-12 education. But I've got to say, we've got a failing public school system in the United States of America. We spend more money on K-12 education per pupil than virtually any country on earth. And we don't get better results. Our results are at best average, and that is true for Wisconsin, and it's true across the country. And, you know, what we've seen over the past years is that there is, I think, strong evidence, Lewis is wrong, that that moving past sort of traditional structures and making room for school choice, educational savings account, charter schools, can actually lead to benefits. Benefits not only in student achievement, but in student outcomes, and particularly for poor kids. So it's really ironic to me when people like Betsy DeVos and Betsy DeVos and her group doesn't give a penny to the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. When people like that put their money where their mouth is, and they commit themselves to attempting to improve public education, particularly for poor children, the people that have some type of interest in sort of this vested industrial era model that we have where one size fits all, somehow question their motives. I think she's an excellent choice. I think, you know, Nikki Haley is chosen for ambassador to the United Nations. I think what is most important for ambassador to the United Nations is someone who is an effective communicator, because you don't make policy as an ambassador to the United Nations. You effectively communicate what the administration's policy is. I think a lot of people believe that Daniel Patrick Moynihan was an excellent ambassador to the United Nations. Goes back a little bit, but Lewis and I will remember him. I don't think he had a lot of foreign policy experience either. So I think that, you know, in making these choices, you know, Trump has shown a lot more of a magnanimous spirit than I actually thought he was capable of. And so, you know, we're still very early in the process. I'm of course, very, very concerned about Supreme Court nominations, but I'm encouraged by what I see.
Yeah. All right. Let's. We have very short time and a couple of important issues to touch on. A panel of federal judges this week ruled 2-1 that Wisconsin's Republican-drawn legislative maps are unconstitutional. They said it was the Republicans' intent to hurt Democrats. Rick, what happens next?
Well, what happens next is, first of all, there's going to be briefing, and the court is going to have to decide on what remedy it wants to order. So it's not a final decision, and it cannot yet be appealed. The appeal here is not to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, but the United States Supreme Court, which may, or and its appeal as of right, but they may or may not give it plenary review. You know, we can talk about, and we go on and on, and I have gone on and on about this case, but it essentially
rests on a premise which doesn't match the premise upon which we elect legislators in the United States. That is, that it imposes a constitutional obligation to draw a map which somehow results in some degree of proportionality between the aggregate partisan vote in, you know, the 99 or 33 statewide or geographic district elections that we have in the state of Wisconsin. We don't elect our legislators that way, and there's no reason to believe that the statewide partisan vote would match the outcome of the districts, particularly since it's a well-established fact that Democratic voters pack themselves or are more packed than Republican voters. And so really what the court said is there was some obligation on the part of the legislature to gerrymander the districts for competitiveness. The fact that the court found intent of the Republicans to benefit themselves, I think the Supreme Court has long recognized that that's going to be true any time you have partisans in the legislature drawing districts. I mean, that's how they do it. They pick the districts that are most favorable to themselves. But the majority also noted in this decision that the Republicans did not depart from, they actually complied with traditional redistricting principles. So if this goes up to the Supreme Court, somebody, Anthony Kennedy, I suppose, is going to have to change the position that they have taken in the past in order for the this panel decision to survive.
So what do you hope happens or results from this, Lewis?
Let me just respond real quickly to Rick. I mean, that is he has done the ultra kind of right-wing analysis of what's going on here. What's really going on is the fact that districts were drawn, and there's never going to be a perfect district, and there is certain, you know, concentration. In Milwaukee's a heavily Democratic area. Waukesha is a heavily Republican area. But these maps were drawn state of Wisconsin's taxpayers spent close to $1 million paying a conservative law firm to draw these maps for the Republicans. They had it set up where they had locked rooms. They had the Republican legislators had assigned documents that saying that they will not disclose anything they see inside when they look at these maps and that. They knew that they were doing something that was really questionable, to say the least. These districts were drawn in such a way that they were they are probably the most extreme maps drawn in terms of trying to pack or break up these various groups of voters in order to benefit the Republicans. And it was so egregious and so outrageous that this panel of judges that voted to say that this is unconstitutional. There were three judges, two of them were Republican appointees, and one was a Democratic appointment. So it isn't like this is a partisan thing. The guy that wrote the...
We have less than a minute, Lewis, so we got to wrap up. Is there more? Less than a minute.
Okay. What I'm saying is that this is very interesting. I think this will change the way they do redistricting, perhaps, throughout the country if this goes to the Supreme Court. I question whether the state will move it up to the Supreme Court. If they don't, it stays only for the law of the land in the Seventh Circuit. Otherwise, it goes to the entire nation. So we'll see what happens.
Less than 30 seconds, a new poll found that 59% of American voters say Donald Trump should shut down his personal Twitter account. do you think, Rick, that he ought to shut down his Twitter account, or is tweeting acceptable to you?
Well, you know, there were all these stories that Kellyanne Conway would go around trying to hide his phone during the campaign. I don't think he should tweet. I just think that, and it's not that President Obama wasn't given to, you know, the occasional ill-considered.
I'm sorry. I thought I was just going to do a yes or no because we're out of time. Thank you both very much for being with us. Rick Essenberg and Lewis Fortas. This is the Ideas Network.